And Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning. Today, we're going to deal with tax reform and looking at one of a couple proposals that have been bandied about in our tax reform work group. And so I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 567. I should also say that we are hoping to move our other bill, Senate Bill 777, down to Ways and Means. We don't have all the paperwork in yet, but hopefully we will by the time we end this morning. And so back to 567. Paul, do you want to get us going?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have a new version of Senate Bill 567. The dash one amendment is replaces the initial bill. And what that does is it directs Department of Revenue to estimate the annual average amount of revenue received from personal income taxes on capital gains during three consecutive years, and to compare the annual average of the next 2 years with those three prior years. The base would be determined no later than May 15th of an odd-numbered year, and then the following odd-numbered year by June 15, the two-year interval, the most recent 2 years, would be compared with the previous 3 years. If there's excess revenue resulting from that calculation, then that excess would be allocated to the Education Stability Fund. Some of the language in here, the Department of Revenue is directed to retain unreceded revenue from taxes, Chapter 316, which is the personal income tax, so that the estimated excess capital gains revenue never technically touches the general fund. There is a timing issue of when this would begin. The way the wording is now, it could begin with this coming biennium, but there are some reasons you may want to think about pushing that out another biennium, given what we're seeing happen in the revenue patterns. But I thought a couple of things to show you. One would be the chart, just to remind you of why we're focusing on capital gains income. This is really another example of the chair's Swiss Alps, and with the peaks and valleys coinciding, the timing of it perfectly with the revenue dips, the special sessions, the budget cuts that you had to make in 2001-2002 period, and then again in the Great Recession from 2009 through 2011. And you can see the peak years where this is income now. So income reached $10 billion in 2007 and then dropped all the way down to $2 billion by 2009. So an 80% drop over a two-year period. And recalling the recommendation from the Pew Research Center about managing your reserve funds, the recommendation was to determine which are your most volatile revenue sources, and this is your most volatile component, and find a way to set aside a portion of that revenue, recognizing that these peaks are not sustainable. And so this is what this amendment tries to do, is go through and clip off those peaks and put them in the Education Stability Fund, which is the constitutional fund. The Ed Stability Fund is a constitutional fund, but this would be, under this proposal, would be a statutory revenue source that flows into it. I did run a simulation for you to look at, and, well, maybe have better luck looking on your screen.
Eyes aren't quite that good.
This is your eye test, Senator.
It's the eye test?
Yeah.
E-I.
Yes. Yeah, what's the highest line you can read there?
There you go.
The table here is a result of a simulation. Historically, I've gone through and looked at income, which we have a data series on income from capital gains. Of course, when taxpayers pay taxes on capital gains, they're not marked in any way. So we have to go back and have an imputed tax rate. And I went back and calculated those imputed rates, usually near the top rate. For example, during the early 80s, I used 9.5. We had a 10% top rate at that time. There was a rate bump up to 10.8% in the recession of the early 80s, so I assumed 10.5% during the period. And finally, as we get into the Measure 66 period of 09, 10, and 11, where we had an 11% rate, assumed a 10.5, and then now with a 9.9 top rate, I assume about 9.5% going forward. So those are estimates. But those are the kinds of estimates that would have to be made to do this calculation for the excess dollars.
I've been explaining this as in taking the windfalls that come from a high capital gains year, and instead of spending those windfalls, put them into the stability fund, which I think is an easy way to explain it, and it's fairly accurate. Mm-hmm. The way you've set this up with two of the three years is not necessarily complicated. It's intricate, more intricate. Can you explain how this is a better, more exact way to estimate those than the earlier iterations where we just took anything over 30% or something?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, just the idea here is to try to determine a trend and to use that trend as a base. One of the things that we were trying to do with this format is to get away from any forecasting element to it. There is no forecasting here. So, for example, if you were to look at the bottom of the chart, your calculation for 2015, if we were to do this now in May of this year, your estimate would be about $450 million, which would be the excess. That number is the annual average for the 13-14 tax years, which would be estimated, minus the annual average for the 10, 11, and 12 tax years.
Okay.
So you're taking the most recent 2 years average and comparing them with the prior 3 years average. And we were just trying to get 3 years in there for that trend, just to make it a little bit more stable over time.
So if this law were on the books, say it passed, 5 years ago, what would we be looking at this year?
This is what we would be looking at. Would be, you can see the amount that would be put into the reserve fund. It's under that excess revenue column. If you go back to the 80s, you generally have 20 to $50 million. That was the period of the long bull market. Not a lot of volatility in that period. Economists call that the Great Moderation. And you had generally strong capital gains. So there would be constantly generating a surplus into it. Those numbers got big in the 90s when the tech boom really began to take hold. $131 million in 95, $120 in 97, and then the top would be at $354 million in 99, and then finally in 01 would be another $300 million allocation. This would be at the peak of the stock market bubble of that period. If you would have been accumulating all of that during that period, you would have had $1,083,000,000 for dollars that would be available. Now, if you look on the last column, you can see that the amount of shortfall in the 01-03 period, the last column is general fund minus the forecast, that would be $1,689,000,000. So you'd have over $1 billion accumulated over a 10-year or really over a 20-year period, and then there would be a shortfall of $1.7 billion. So you're covering over half your shortfall in that period, but that was a severe drop. And, of course, you can see that if you just look at those two-year averages, capital gains income dropped sharply. And if you do the calculation in 03, you're minus $455 million. So.
And it's this difference here that would be deposited into the education fund?
Yes, it's the excess revenue that would go in, and that's that third to the last column there. So you'd make your final in this 01 period, your final deposit would be $300 million. That would give you $1,083,000,000, and then you'd have a $1.7 billion shortfall in that biennium. So you'd be able to cover over half the shortfall in that particular period.
Right. So say this loan were on the books this year, 2015.
So if you look at 2015, you would be making a deposit now. In June of this year, and this is based on the March forecast, you would deposit $450 million.
Okay, and that would be $450 that would not be available for this 15-17 budget.
That's correct. That's correct. And you can see that if you look at the general fund difference in the estimate so far is about 358. And that's not the kicker calculation because that's corporate plus personal, total general fund. So we're running about $350 million over. Capital gains calculation be about $450 million. You'd also have, once you made that deposit, $652 million from this source going forward. Of course, you'd also have the 18% of lottery, which is a little short of $200 million now.
Senator Burchaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Paul, you know, I can't figure out if my funny bone hurts because of weather change or stock market change. But what if we took $7.6 billion that you have there and changed that to $9.6 billion? Because I have a funny feeling we might have a peak maybe this fall. It's probably hard to do right now, but what kind of numbers would that generate?
Well, you know, I think I would look back.
2007.
Exactly. If you look back on the Great Recession, numbers there, you can see, even though you would have drained, and I would assume the account would have been drained, that you would have spent the $1.083 billion in 2003. And those of you that were here, I'm sure, would believe that. So the account drops to zero, but then you still have with the 2005-2007 biennium, you have a $686 million deposit. So you'd still have $688 million going into the Great Recession. And in fact, if you do the calculation, because of the lag, and this would be, the timing doesn't fit always correctly with exactly when the funds are needed, but you'd have other options. In the 2009 section, you would actually have a $50 million excess because you're comparing 2007 and 2008, really before the stock market really crashed, even though by 2009 we certainly recognized the economy was in deep recession. So there is a little bit of a lag there, but that $50 million, of course, could be deposited and then turned around and allocated with a three-fifths majority out of the Education Stability Fund to balance the budget. And again, if you look at the...
We could still steal it.
Yeah.
That's you what
can,
you're saying.
You can steal it. Well, and Senator, as you know, you can steal it in the sense of the three-fifths vote, but it is still much more stringent, the constitutional fund, than it is in the statutory fund, which just requires the notwithstanding provision.
The we is right. He'd have to vote for it, too, in order to steal it.
Yeah. And the way I look at that is, well, that's true. If you don't have this, you're stealing it right when it comes off the boat.
No, you're taking. Not stealing it, definitely. Yeah. You're just taking.
Chris had a question.
Senator Edwards.
Yeah, thank you. So, go back several steps, and if you could, Paul, and explain to me how we get to the excess revenue, the 450. That is the difference between, that's not the difference between the two-year average and three-year average, or this year's versus the three-year. It is what?
It is the difference. Well, I think it's easier to think of the years that it's that it would involve. It's the difference between, if you're looking at spring of 2015 now, we were doing this calculation today, we'd estimate capital gains tax revenue for the 13 and 14 years, and we'd average that. So we'd have an average of those 2 years, and we'd compare that with the average capital gains revenue for 10, 11, and 12, the three. So you're comparing 13 and 14 with 10, 11, and 12, taking that annual average and then multiply it by two.
Okay, so that's not already figured in these columns yet. You have to go
the
back
2 year,
and add.
Well, yes, the 2 year. What I, if you look at the 2 year average here, would be the 14 with that 2 year average is compared to the 3 year average in 12, multiplied by two.
So Paul, for us farmers, you're going to average the last 2 years, and then you're going to average the third, fourth, and fifth year ago, average that, and then you're going to average those two averages.
I'm going to subtract those two averages, and if it's a positive number, you multiply it by two and put it in the Education Stability Fund. and that becomes a deposit in June at the end of the biennium.
And for this year, that would be 450?
That would be 450, yes. And in 13, it would have been 2003.
And so, Paul, if we force this across the floor in both chambers right now, both Senator Devlin and Representative Buckley would have heart attacks, right? Because it would reduce the co-chair's budget.
Which is why he said you might implement it for the next biennium.
That's right.
Yes, you may want to think of a start date to give the co-chairs the time to catch their breath.
Settle in.
That's right.
Well, you can see what as soon as in some ways, the sooner the better. I mean, look at right. what yeah. somebody would
this
have
is
had
when
a
we needed
to do this
most.
20 years ago.
Right. This mm-hmm. is when we needed right. them. I mean, you know, if...
Well, that's,
if,
that's if always, you're, that is always inherent in yeah. any kind of a savings plan.
Yeah. 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 The crash is coming.
Yes.
Or well, some of us believe it's coming.
But I think another perspective to keep in mind is if you look at those differences, the thing about the Great Recession was it actually was the difference in 2001-2003 was bigger. But the problem with the Great Recession, you had two huge back-to-back shortfalls, one at
right.
$1.3 billion, the other $1.1
billion. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's pretty much unprecedented. Even the early 80s, you didn't have that situation.
Double whammy.
So
right.
That's what I think really was made it very difficult for the budget.
So your hesitation on the time, you know, when to implement this is because of what Senator Edwards just said, that for planning the next budgetary plan.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think that would be give some time to prepare that and to build that into the budget planning process. The way it would work is that you would have the state economist making his projection on what capital gains will be. And in his projection, he may look, he'll calculate this and say, okay, if I'm right, there's going to be an excess of this amount. Now, that won't be deposited until it's actually realized, but it really couldn't in good faith be budgeted because it's spoken for
right.
and under the statute. The only other thing that I had thought about in terms of a possible amendment would be to change the Section 1 direction to the Department of Revenue and change this to Department of Administrative Services in consultation with Department of Revenue. In other words, the state economists make that calculation. It's more in line with it, what he does. So that would be the other tweak I would suggest.
Is that in that ones?
Mr. Chair, it's not in the ones now. I would suggest that as a change for a two.
Okay.
For the twos.
Right. Well, let's do that. But where is the House? They have this exact scenario.
The House has the same bill, and so I think you could well see this come over from them.
Sure. Question. So is the House then considering doing this the smart way, which is put all the eggs in one basket back with the state economist?
Yes.
They're going to have a dash two and number two.
Yes.
Safe to say you're running both tables, aren't you?
Yes.
Yes.
That's efficient, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, it is.
So, but I think, you know, this kind of a calculation is something that we have been looking at for quite a while. I think both committees have.
I guess we could term this, Mr. Chair, forced constitutional savings. Actually passed in good times, because the last two times we passed these in bad times. Kind of like a knee-jerk reaction. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what a concept. Any other questions on our savings plan, Senator Riley?
No.
You okay?
Yeah, I guess. It's going to be it's going to be tough.
This short term.
Short term is going to be tough. Yeah.
It's like any savings plan.
Yes.
You want to spend it. The needs are there. You're going to tuck it away for Christmas.
No, for schools.
For schools.
Not Christmas.
Yeah, which is half our budget.
Okay, well, we'll see. The House has got a work session coming up.
Yes, I think we're looking at a potential work session next week.
Okay. We'll wait for them. We won't race them to the top, but we'll look for it. With no other questions, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 567, and I'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 777, I saw Cedric Hayden, Representative Hayden is here along with Michael Parker. Do you guys want to come up and talk about the amendments? And first, Christina.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 777, as you can see, has the A2 amendment. And what this would do would be to limit the possibility of having tax free savings for only to beneficiaries who are under 21 years of age. The measure overall would direct the Oregon 529 Savings Board to establish a ABLE program. And this would allow persons with disabilities to establish savings accounts for their disability-related expenses, but also would be used for expenses such as housing or transportation. Both the contributions to and the distributions from the account are exempt from taxable income. And it provides for the taxation of distributions that are not for qualified disability expenses. And the measure also adds a representative of persons with disabilities to the Oregon 529 Savings Board and removes the requirement that a representative of the State Board of Higher Education serve on the board. And it also removes the requirement that the Oregon University System provide administrative staff to the board. There is a fiscal light statement on the measure so that it may move to Ways and Means. It also has a revenue impact of around negative $700,000 per biennium. And this is kind of, I use some Department of Education statistics on the amount of children at school age receiving special education for various types of disabilities and then applied that to the population and then expanded it based on the population of children age 0 to 21 in the state. Assumed they were quite a little bit more likely to participate in this program than the Oregon 529 College Savings Plan. This is because disabled individuals who receive assistance may have to comply with prohibitions on saving more than a limited amount of money, and this would be an avenue for savings that would not disqualify an individual for benefits. So in some cases, they're only avenue for savings. When there is a new or expanded tax expenditure, there's often a purpose statement, and I proposed one so far. And it says, the purpose of this tax expenditure is to help disabled people to save money for necessary expenses to meet the challenges of life. So if there are any edits to that purpose statement, please let me know, and we can evolve that as we move forward.
Why did you do the purpose statement?
Mr. Chair, it has been our policy to, whenever a new tax expenditure is put in place, to have a purpose statement, at least into the legislative documents, and this helps the Department of Revenue when they do their tax expenditure report, and also to have a purpose attached to the any new expenditures.
I think that's good. I just was wondering, where did it go?
The purpose statement.
It's not in the amendment.
No, Mr. Chair, the purpose statement simply lives in the revenue impact statement document.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
And then the documentation for that tax expenditure will often refer to that.
So when we have that book, tax expenditures,
that's where it'll be.
Gentlemen, Representative, thank you for your patience, and if you want to, I'm glad you were able to see our capital gains savings account plan.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Cedric Hayden. Okay, I'll start, and then you can do the details. This bill is an important bill. I want to go over a couple of things, a great explanation there of what it does do, but one of the importances that I don't know that gets picked up in the detail is that it also helps with assistive technology. Under our current process now, people with disabilities can get a wheelchair for their home activities, but they can't get any assistance in wheelchairs that would help them go to the grocery store, something like that. And so for disabled folks in the position without the ABLE account aren't even allowed to save enough money to buy that type of wheelchair, or their donor couldn't put in their bank account until this. So there's some medical needs that are attached that is taking care of some helpful regulations that's coming, we're told is coming on the federal side, but it isn't here yet for these people to be able to, you know, get out into the communities. So I think that's an important footnote to know here. Also on the spending, there is some flexibility in it. They've kind of, on the fiscal, they've set this at kind of a top bar, I believe, with saying that they're going to have two personnel at a top level or a step one level. But they do have flexibility built in that, that maybe they would have one at the higher level pay and one at a lower level pay, and the participation might not be as much as they want. So I think there's important to note that even though there is quite a bit of fiscal money here, it's not coming from the general fund. It's actually coming from participants of 529 plans to cover that cost until the people in the plan with the disabled or the ABLE account is to cover it at own expense. Having said that, I guess when the review of this got put together, it originally allowed anybody, because you only have to have a disability prior to the age of 26 in order to qualify for this account. That means it had to be diagnosed before the age of 26, not that you enter the account. So there's an amendment, a dashed A2 amendment, that is saying, and back me up here in a second, is saying that in order to get the tax-free benefit for the state of Oregon, you have to be 21 or under when you enter instead of any age. Any age can still enter if they have the diagnosis before 26 years of age, but they only get the tax-free benefit if they enter 21 and under.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, for the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the 529 College Savings Network. Representative Hayden is correct. The amendment really calls for us to kind of match this a little bit with the College Savings Plan, in that when you have a diagnosis of a disability for a child under the age of 21, monies go into the account and you can take the state tax deduction at that point. After the child reaches 21 and over, contributions will not be state tax deductible. They will still receive the tax-free growth, state and federally, but no more state tax deduction can be taken after the child reaches the age of 21. And that kind of matches the, you know, if you're saving for college through this or something else, that kind of matches the College Savings Plan account now. So again, it keeps the revenue impact down as well. So that we support that amendment as well.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you. I mean, first, I have a conflict of interest. So. That should be on the record, but I guess representative, I mean, as you pointed out, the fiscal's interesting, because I ran the calculations out, and this is the concern. First, I support the program, so that's not the debate. The question is that the last fiscal is $673,000, as you know. If you just run that out at 2% interest, which is actually pretty good if you're getting 2% interest these days, there's got to be about $17 million in this account before it just breaks even and pays for itself. And so if my daughter's in this account and she's paying for it, I mean, the first $700,000 is going to go to the state. And my question before is, I mean, to the treasurer's office, I guess, is, I mean, as the good representative pointed out, it's a pretty big chunk of change right off the bat. I mean, is there any anticipation of how large the accounts would get, when it would become self-supporting, and at what point hypothetically would the depositors into the account, which are the disabled, actually be making money versus losing money in this
thank you for the question. And for the record, if I didn't say it, my name is Cedric Hayden, state representative from House District 7. I think there's a lot of factors, and even in our fiscal impact statement, that the measure does not specifically limit the amount of the assessment. I read that pretty closely because I do have, I don't think it's conflict of interest, but I do have a disabled daughter and will certainly be looking at this plan for her future. There are several other states that have adopted plans like this, and I've read that there's 29 states that are looking at legislation for it. And so it is important for Oregon to stay competitive, and so that we have a plan that looks attractive so that we can recruit. And my understanding, correct me if I'm incorrect, is that this wouldn't be limited just for participants from the state of Oregon. So I don't think that $17 million into a plan like that is a very high bar to reach. I think that people will come and utilize a plan like this. It's been 8 years, and for those of us that have been watching it, it's been 8 years in coming. And even though it doesn't get a lot of news review and attention, it's something that a lot of people have waited quite a while for.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I mean, you're right. It's really hard for us to look at how much this plan's going to take in over time. Working with some of our financial folks that work on our college savings program, you know, we look at like a 5 to 7 year time period for assets to come in. The real issue here is it's a closed system. It's not just everyone saving for college. It's only disabled parents or adults, and then those folks who want to put the money in. So in regards to the fiscal, we want to keep it as low as possible. The real big part of that fiscal is having a person that's going to actually actively engage participants to be in the program. We're not looking at doing a big marketing campaign for this like we do with college savings currently. So the most of this money is really going to go towards personnel to get out to activate the groups to make them understand this program is there, how it works. The real difference here, again, from college savings, is a lot more rules for this plan, who qualifies, who doesn't. And so there's going to be a lot of education needed. Rather than just going out and saying to a parent, hey, save for college because it's good for your future, this is going to be there's a lot more sit-down education with this. So we're going to have people sitting down with folks and educate them about how this program really works. So the fiscal, like I said, we want to keep it as low as possible in the future biennia, and we will really attempt to do that, but really want to make sure that the plan's successful. The more we talk about it and we educate, the more assets will come in.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. So just to make sure that I understand so 529s, those you can choose any plans, or excuse me, any state's 529 plan, not just your own state. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, that's correct. In the world of college savings plans, you can go anywhere you want.
Right. So then, and is this the same then? Would these ABLE accounts be the same? You could choose any state's plan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, no. That's kind of the real urgency, as Representative Hayden said, is states have to pass a law to activate this for their participants. So an Oregonian, absent us passing a law, absent the legislature passing a law, could not go to a state that has one set up and invest in it and take advantage of the federal law. The state legislature has to do something to put something in place for those disabled Oregonians to take advantage of it.
Okay. And then I do have one more follow-up. Is there a provision in the bill in underlying 529 plans that would allow for, if there is a 529 currently set up for a child, say my son, conflict of interest, and we were to establish an ABLE account for him, could we transfer the money that's in his current 529 over to the ABLE account?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is a great question. I'll give you the quick lay of the land. President Obama signed this back in December into law. Typically what happens in these situations is then the IRS would then pass or promulgate rules that interprets the law, and then it comes down to us, and then we follow those rules. The IRS has said currently that they're not going to promulgate any rules right away, but they're going to give states the ability to set these plans up and interpret the rules themselves. So in that case, what's going to happen, to your question, there's going to be a lot of these questions similar to that. The College Savings Board, if this law passes, will promulgate administrative rules, and look at those situations. So we imagine we'll engage a number of attorneys to look at the law that was passed, and promulgate rules based on advice of a lot of counsel. So my thought on that is it should be that should. If it was me, I'd say yes, because a situation where a child is a normal developing child at age 3 somehow becomes disabled at age 10, you should be able to transfer that money. So it seems like an obvious rule, but again, we're going to have to be interpreting the federal statutes ourselves.
Or say, one last comment, or say doesn't become disabled at age 10, but say at age 12 a college savings account was started. And at age 13, the state established this, and would have, you know, I mean.
Correct.
Is this a hypothetical?
Mr. Chair,
hypothetically
Edwards,
speaking.
Right. I believe it's almost a very obvious rule that we should look at. Again, I think that we'll be looking at a lot of those things very, very closely, but I think that should be an obvious one. At least a transfer should be allowed.
If I might, thank you for the question, Senator Edwards. Cedric Hayden. From my perspective, we're going to do everything that we can to make those funds available to be transferable over. I have five 529 plans for my five children, and I think it only makes sense to be able to do that. And from my understanding of the lack of the regulation on the federal side right now, we are able to start by doing that, and only if the feds came in and said that was disallowed would we have to deal with something in the future. My understanding of
it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The answer about getting into other states' plans, you said we must create a plan, but I didn't hear the answer of once we've created a plan, can you go to other states that has a plan? Are those...
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, how it would work is once a state establishes a plan, its residents can invest. Mm-hmm. If a state does not establish a plan, but in a sense says that we want to partner with a state that has a plan, then those residents can go. But there has to be some action taken. So if I'm understanding your question properly, if there's two states that have plans, can they flip-flop? No. The answer is no. Only if the state of Oregon said, you can either invest in Oregon's plan, or if California has one, then you can invest in California's. But without that direction, they can only invest in the state's plan.
And then it would take both states to agree.
It would take both states to agree. That is correct.
Thank you.
A follow-up, just cut to the chase here. In this bill that you want us to vote on, is that going to be possible?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bocas, is it going to be possible to flip?
Are we giving you the authority in this bill for you to do this?
You are not giving us the authority to go to another state. You're giving us the authority to put a plan in place for Oregonians here in this state.
And can someone, but you did testify that someone from out of the state under this bill will be able to come to Oregon and put it.
If in fact... their legislature passed a law, they could come to us and say, hey, can we participate in your plan? Again, my sense is we would have to get some sort of direction if we would allow them back in. I'm not a lawyer, I don't know that, but specifically this law does not say anything about crossing over.
Hold on, Mr. Chair. Okay, just for clarity, and I'll let the representative answer this, because we're probably going to have to do this in stages, this session, next session, but I think what we were saying earlier was our goal was to create the plan and then get other people to come here too, so that we can make these guys do it cheaper. Mm-hmm. Isn't that the plan?
Senator Boquist, that is my understanding of the plan. And again, the rules, it has a $100,000 and possibly another $100,000 for attorney fees in here to set up these rules, and the federal government has not laid those out for the state of Oregon. So my understanding is when those rules get developed that Oregon has to have a plan in order for Oregonians to participate. And then states that have a plan that allow their state to participate, their rules, if they say you can go participate in, say, California or another state that has a qualified plan, then Californians could invest in the Oregon plan. I believe that we allow that. And I believe it hasn't been fully developed in this whether Oregonians could go to California or not. My intent would be for that flexibility, but I don't think, honestly, we can say that those rules are written yet.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Bocas, I think the reason why that was developed like that federally is that if a state, let's say California, doesn't want to develop a plan, doesn't want to go through the process, but they say, hey, you know, it's fine if you want to invest in the five states that have a plan, go ahead and do that. But they have that state that doesn't want to develop it has to give the citizens permission to go outside the state. But to your point, yes, if we develop a great plan here, we would love to have other folks invest in it out of state.
Yeah, so thank you. So I have what you just said sparked another question. So yeah, to make sure that I understand this correctly, so the federal enabling legislation requires that a state establish this ability, the ability to invest in an ABLE account either outside of your state, or you can create one in your state with permissions to also invest outside of your state. But if your state is going to receive money from outside the state into yours, you must allow your residents, citizens, to invest. There has to be a reciprocity. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Senator, that is correct. Someone from California, absent the ability, would not be able to come here. They would have to have the ability of that state to say, yes, we allow you to go invest in ABLE in the state of Oregon. That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
All righty. This is destined for Ways and Means because of the expenditure. We now just received the appropriate fiscal light paperwork. We have a revenue impact statement. We have a -1 amendment. Senator Bocas.
Mr. Chair, I move the A2 into the main bill, SB 77.
Pardon me, -2 amendments. Senator Bocas moves the -2s into 777. Discussion? Seeing none, objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 777 as amended by the A2 be reported out with a due pass recommendation. The bill be referred to the Committee on Joint Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Bocas moves the -2s amended into the Senate Bill 777 be sent to the Ways and Means Committee by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Senator Burchard.
Yes, the fiscal on it is somewhat of an eye-opener, but I will be voting yes to move it along the Ways and Means.
And same here, Mr. Chair. I just ask Treasury to figure out a way to do this cheaper so that we're not taking money out of the hands of disabled.
Okay. Further discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. Senate Bill 777, as amended, will be sent to the Ways and Means Committee by prior reference. Thanks again to all of the families and advocates who participated in this, who advocated for it. And today was a victory for you. We move on to the next station. Okay. That is all we have on our agenda today. We have a tax credit committee on Thursday. It is unlikely that we'll meet on Monday. However, a subset may meet on looking at tax reform and tax credit issues. So with that, we will adjourn. With that, we will adjourn.